Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Broadcasting from Resistance Headquarters, relentlessly fighting back against the clown dictator and his regime of deplorables.
Never give up, never surrender.
This is the Bob Zeska Show, presented by BubbleGenius.com.
From our nation's capital, it is Wednesday, September 11, 2019, and this is the interview edition of the Bob Zeska Show on the Sexy Liberal Podcast Network. My guest today is one of my favorite follows on Twitter, the great Ed Bott. Ed is an award-winning technology writer with more than 2 decades' experience writing for mainstream media outlets and online publications. Make sure to follow his column on ZDNet, as well as his award-winning Twitter feeds. Links in the description below. Today we'll talk about everything from social media propaganda to the Snowden NSA story to deepfakes to the new version of the iPhone. Meanwhile, if you dig the show, please support this podcast by subscribing to our Patreon page at BobSeskaShow.com. All right, let's talk with Ed Bott. Ed Bott, it's great to talk to you finally. What are you up to these days?
Just the same old, spending too much time on Twitter, but doing my day job at ZDNet, right. Covering the technology business, which is fairly active these days.
Do you have any new books in the works?
Waiting for the third edition of Windows 10 Inside Out came out a few months ago, and we'll be starting on the fourth edition probably around the end of this year. So I get a little break between books right now, which is nice.
You know, I want to come back to Windows because I have a lot to say, probably for the most part agreeing with you about Windows. But before we dig into all of that, I just wanted to mention right out of the chute here, we first bumped into each other in 2013 during the whole Snowden fiasco. I remember we were both tweeting extensively about that thing. You were also recognized that year by Time Magazine for your Twitter presence. What was your take on that episode with the NSA and Greenwald and Snowden and Russia? Seems like a bit of a precursor to some of the stuff that we've been witnessing since then, hasn't it?
Oh, man, doesn't it? I went back just a couple of weeks ago, in fact, and looked at some of that material.
Yeah.
And I said, boy, a lot of the takes that people had on Snowden's role and just, you know, the way everything unfolded there haven't aged very well. It's,
no.
You know, it's like, we still don't know. There's still so much more that we don't know than we do. And it's like a whole bunch of those details just went into the memory hole.
Absolutely. And in the process of discussing what happened in the 2016 election, what continues to happen today, we kind of forget that Edward Snowden is still a welcome guest of Vladimir Putin in Moscow. I mean, he's still there. He's still probably being extensively eavesdropped upon by Putin, which is ironic, of course. Now, do you think the Snowden operation was maybe Putin testing the waters to see how well he could scramble the discourse here?
Oh, you know, I suppose that's possible. You know, Occam's razor says it's probably simpler than that. It was an opportunistic thing. Mm-hmm. It's entirely possible that Snowden really is and continues to be the idealist that he said he was, yeah. And there, you know, and that would be consistent with the facts that we know about it. That doesn't mean, however, that a whole bunch of other people didn't immediately latch on to the whole affair and use it for their own advantage. The way things have gone beyond that, I think, have been darker. Mm-hmm. Many of the later things that went through WikiLeaks, the extraction of the hacking tools, for example, you know, those were much darker and much more difficult to find a plausible, innocent explanation for.
Yeah, and the thing that we did witness in that time, and in fact, a lot of my coverage of the Snowden-Greenwald saga circulated around a lot of, I don't know if I would necessarily say it was fake news, but a lot of headlines circulating on social media and on the blogs and elsewhere that didn't match up with the content of the articles. There's a lot of hype and miscommunication about a very technically complicated thing. Did you see the same thing too? I mean, were you seeing a lot of the misreporting and mishandling of this information?
Yes, although it was a microcosm of what we saw later.
Yeah.
What we saw later, you know, in 2016, all of the stuff about Hillary's email server and you know, a lot of the rumors that mm-hmm. that were being spread, particularly through dark Facebook ads, you know, about Hillary's health, for example. You know, there was a lot of that stuff that was going around that was a more or less traditional influence operation aimed at bubbling up to the general public. Mm-hmm. The Snowden thing was different in a way because it was, by and large, national security reporters, people who had a reputation for doing these stories, people like Barton Gellman and Greenwald and other people like that, who had far more experience than the average journalist, the average mainstream tech press person had, for that matter. But it was such a confusing story, mm-hmm. and it was also such a controversy laden story, you know. So it was so easy to paint it as the NSA has complete access to every communication by every person in the world,
right?
When it, you know, and that certainly might be true. I mean, those big data centers in Nevada, you know, aren't that big for nothing, mm-hmm. but the general scope of a lot of the Operation Prism thing, for example, was a way to turn national security warrants into something that could be satisfied, boom, like that, instead of having to go through a complicated process of you know, sending out letters and, you know, something that could take a day or two. Previously, you know, they could literally do with the flip of a switch. Mm-hmm. But I mean, that's a really hard thing to explain.
Yeah,
it's a really hard thing to understand, and it's even more difficult when the companies that are actually doing the cooperation under legal process for these things, the mm-hmm. Microsofts and Googles and Yahoos of the world, are legally prohibited from discussing any aspect of it. So you're sort of forced into a story at that point where a lot of the players can't tell you the truth. And, you know, and I would talk to people who were involved in this, and they would, you know, in face-to-face conversations, and it would be one of those things where I'd ask a question and I'd get a nod. And, you know, like not even a, I can't answer that, or no comment. It would just be just a nod.
because
that's how serious the, you know, back at that point, it's been relaxed somewhat since then. Mm-hmm. But back then, if you received a national security letter, you were legally prohibited from disclosing even the fact that you had received it.
Yeah, and in fact, I think a lot of that secrecy and confusion about the topic lent itself to, or created basically a giant opening for there to be a lot of misinformation thrown into the works. It seems like everyone today is still willing. I mean, we're now how many years past the whole Snowden thing? Everyone's still willing to blindly hand over their digital footprint to any app or website without any already questions or outrage there. I mean, there was a famous app that everyone was using, this app. I don't know. I forget exactly what the app did. It changed their face or something like that. It wasn't deepfakes. It was something else. And everyone was playing along with that on social media. And then only to find out later that, oh, yeah, the app was horking all of their personal information. Really smart. So, right. I mean, what is the difference there? I mean, why were people more suspicious of the NSA with its warrants and oversight versus corporations that had no oversight and no warrants whatsoever?
Well, I think there's a tendency on the part of the general public to look at everything as binary. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, things are either good or bad. And the NSA got painted as spies and bad. Yeah. And there was no nuance associated with that whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And with Google, you know, everyone knows Google search. Yeah. Everyone loves it. Everyone has their Gmail account. They, you know, for the longest time, I mean, I think that's crumbled a little bit in recent years, but still, you know, the company is basically trusted. And so, you know, and anything that you do, it's involved with Google. It's like people say, well, that's fine. It's Google. And I trust them. I remember having some conversations. I was on a podcast one time, and the conversation of privacy came up, and I said, you know, and I said something very similar to what you said, which is that, you know, you are helping large organizations that are basically advertising funded build tremendously rich and detailed dossiers on you,
yeah,
all the time with your actions. And the reply that I got was, well, yeah, but that's okay. I want Google to have that information because then they'll use it to help me. And I said, well, that's great. And I mean, you know, the idea is, you know, they're going to help me manage my calendar. They're going to help me avoid traffic so I can get to my appointments on time, all the things that you're used to seeing on your phone, right? And I said, well, but, you know, what happens? They said, that's, you know, we're a couple of successful middle-aged white guys. What if you're a person of color?
Yeah.
And, you know, your browsing history and your location is being tracked everywhere. And at some point you go to apply for a loan and your Google dossier is used basically to, you know, to deny you that loan because there's something in your record there that they don't like. You know, you've made too many trips to, you know, the off-track betting parlor.
That's right.
And so you're gonna deny you that, and you'll never know that. And they said, well, you know, but Google doesn't do that. I said, Google doesn't do that today, but that information is there and it's permanent. And guess what happens to companies when they fall on hard times? You know, when the earnings start to drop, when the profits start to drop, when there's pressure to meet Wall Street's, you know, meet Wall Street's demands, or when there's a change in management. Mm-hmm. You know, the management that today is saying, no, we don't do that. The new management comes in and says, yeah, we'll do that.
Right,
and,
right.
And you've already given them your data. Sorry, it's too late.
Exactly. And that's what I experienced. In fact, I just recalled what exactly that app was that I was referring to a second ago. It was an app that made your face look like an old person, like an old version of what you would look like. And it turned out that they were just doing a lot of data mining. And in fact, we had just read a bunch of reports, maybe a month or three prior to that, about how a lot of these apps that people play with on social media, they're not really for the fun thing that they purport to be. They're actually data mining. And so, sure. And we're so willing to just say, hey, well, as long as I can have some fun and increase my, my reach on Facebook, I'll just hand over all of my information. Who cares? I mean, it's, you know, terms of service. Who needs to read that? So,
well, and that's it. And that's if you're even aware of it.
Yeah. Right. Right.
You know, because there's a significant number of people. And in fact, you know, this is basically the core of the problem that Western liberal democracy faces.
Yes.
Is there's a large cohort of the voting public that is frankly unsophisticated. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. You know, you shouldn't have to pass. We have enough experience with literacy tests and such that we know that you shouldn't have to pass an intelligence test to, you know, to cast your vote. But the trouble is that people who are unsophisticated can be easily manipulated for good or for ill.
That's right.
And when it's happening in ways that are either not obvious or are deliberately deceptive, then you wind up, well, basically where we are.
Do you think it'd be worthwhile, and this is something that I've just been spitballing casually these days, but, you know, the more I think about it, the more it seems like something that ought to be doable. I mean, do you think it'd be worthwhile or practical to have a sort of driver's ed for the internet? Maybe start with teens in high school, you know, where a guy comes in. Remember the driver's ed class? I don't know if you went through this, Ed.
Oh, but sure.
Like the scared shitless film strips that we would see of all of the brutal accidents on the highways, and so people with their face caved in.
The classic was from Ohio. It was called Red Asphalt. That's the one that they showed. They showed everyone back. And actually, if anyone Googles that, they'll probably be able to figure out just how old I am. But I was having a conversation the other day with my wife, and we were talking about this very topic, about some of the core things that people need to understand,
that we
should be teaching in high schools: economic literacy, how credit works,
and
how the internet works, and
the things to avoid on the internet,
and how to be a skeptical news consumer.
Yes,
you know, these are all things that we should be teaching. But honestly, you know, when you have I don't want to pick on Texas, but they're right next door to me, and you know, they in the last decade, you know, I remember reading about the textbooks that they rewrote to put creationism back into them.
Oh right,
alongside. So I'm always, you know, I'm deeply skeptical about the idea of putting a curriculum in place to teach people about how to detect fake news, because guess what happens when it's taken over by the wrong people?
Right. And fast forwarding to older internet users as well. I mean, my dad has an iPad at age 81, and he barely knows how to navigate email in terms of phishing scams and so on that drop into his inbox. Just educating people about what to avoid would be immensely helpful. But, you know, it's just a matter of getting it to happen without it being too heavily politicized. That I think that might be the
Although when you get right down to it, you may have put your finger on one of the more important things is not necessarily to educate the kids, but rather to educate the 65 plus demographic, which is, you know, the research that I've seen says that is the group that is far more likely than any other to be taken in by deceptive messaging, either through both mainstream sources and through, you know, Facebook groups and ads and such. And, you know, they're just not able to distinguish that. And so they share it the same way they used to share chain letters and such. It's it's the need for news literacy is not, I think, age dependent.
Yeah. Again, another thing to add to the list that we could certainly inject into our curriculum now with the right leadership, of course. You know, and ultimately we have this incredible resource at our disposal, but it seems like so many users are kind of screwing it up for the rest of us. I mean, does this ever correct itself, or are we kind of screwed moving forward, where the internet becomes either heavily regulated or continues to worsen as this Wild West environment where 4chan and 8chan kind of dominate the discourse through trolls and so on?
Well, you know, I am naturally an optimist.
Yeah.
And yet on this topic, I think in a way, it's kind of like climate change. We had an opportunity to do something about the mess that the internet and social media have become. Mm-hmm. We had an opportunity to do something like that 10 years, about that 10 years ago. But basically the organizations and the infrastructure that run those now, you know, the those are the biggest companies in the world
Yep.
now. You know, Facebook, Google, Amazon, Microsoft, Apple, the companies that are basically responsible for the information that we consume,
yeah,
have been allowed to grow in without, you know, with basically only the most minimal of regulation. And the idea that any part of that genie could be put back in the bottle is pretty, you know, is I would love to be optimistic about that, but everything that we are doing at this point seems to be trying to stem the tide.
Yep.
You know, I read the other day a statistic that 1.5 million pieces of information related to suicide and self-harm was removed from Facebook over the past 3 months.
Jesus.
And I wanted to scream because I said, you know, isn't the problem here that we have a platform where 1.5 million pieces of information about suicide and self-harm could be posted in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
The biggest problem, you know, people talk about Twitter and Facebook in particular, talk about coordinated inauthentic behavior. I think that's the phrase that they use for networks of bots and network of trolls,
right,
that are out there pushing messages. But I think that's almost a red herring to focus on there. Those are almost too easy to identify.
Mm-hmm.
And the real danger, the bigger dangers are from ordinary people who are radicalized and become sort of lone wolves of misinformation on the internet.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can't identify. They're completely organic. They're completely they're real people,
mm-hmm,
doing horrible things, you know, spreading misinformation. And it's very difficult to think of any strategy where you can stop that.
Yeah, it seems like there's a generation of Americans specifically who kind of were brought up believing the headlines they read in the newspaper and the news reports they saw on the evening news, and have now, sure, translated that, I don't know what you would call it, naivete, faith, whatever. They've translated their observations of the internet with the same point of view, to the point where they're buying all of the gibberish and nonsense, almost like the brainwashing that happens over at Fox News Channel. It's a similar, yeah, dynamic. And I don't think they're necessarily aware that they're being fed bullshit. And the worst part about it is, just adding this and on top of everything else, I think on social media, there's this X factor, which is the inability for a lot of people on social media to admit wrongness. Rather, they want to always save face somehow because their social media presence is so linked to who they are. It's becoming their brand. And so to admit wrongness, to admit that they were wrong about X, Y, or Z news story, contradicts their ability to build their brand. And it seems to me as if that right there can be a major, major crisis as well, don't you think?
I think there's a lot of truth to that, especially when you combine that with the sort of tribalism,
yeah,
that we have that defines, you know, both what we're seeing in the U.S. and now if you go over and, you know, you look at what's happening in the U.K. with Brexit, mm-hmm, you'll see the same sort of tribalism happening over there. It's funny, yeah, over there, of course, blue and red mean exactly the opposite things, but it's, mm-hmm, still the you know, it's still the exact same thing. If you go down into follow a tweet and start looking at the replies, and you'll find you know, just a large number of people who are just parroting what they've been told.
Yep.
And it's, I'm not a both sides-ism believer, but you get this people wanting to punch back from both sides. And so what you wind up with is, as soon as you start following the replies in any thread, it just becomes this level of noise.
Yeah.
And you tune out what you don't agree with,
mm-hmm,
and you amplify and retweet and share what you do agree with. And, you know, and pretty soon, you know, pretty soon the problem is worse. And what you've got in both the US and the UK right now is also a fairly significant percentage of people, you know, easily over 20%, maybe as high as 30%, who there is literally nothing that you could do to change their minds. There is no set of facts that you could give them. There is no, there's no picture, photoshopped or not, no video that they're going to, if it doesn't match with their worldview, they just reject it. If it does match with your worldview, they share it.
Did you, now getting into 2016 on this exact topic, did you observe in real time any of the social media manipulation we later discovered was run by, you know, these troll farms in Russia? And I saw a lot of misinformation just rapidly flying back and forth at the time. So, and it was only later that I realized that it was all part of this coordinated effort by Russia. I mean, did you observe some of the same things?
I observed many of those things. However, I do recall seeing and being suspicious of some of the specific accounts that later turned out to have been traced directly back to GRU. Yeah. One of them was the one that I remember very, very clearly was the 10 GOP, the one that was supposedly the Tennessee Republican Party, but was actually a Russian influence account. And I also remember the probably the most staggering one to me was how quickly all of the stuff about when Hillary Clinton had that episode with pneumonia.
Oh, yes. And, Jesus.
How quickly those pictures and the theories around them started spreading on Facebook and on Twitter and in the you know, the darker, stupider corners of the internet. I mean, they just, it was genuinely remarkable how quickly those things spread. And again, it was because there were people who had an extremely vested interest in making sure that that stuff got pushed out, the Roger Stones of the world, right? And then it was also people who were just thrilled to have yet one more conspiracy theory that they could share with their friends. And so that was sort of the perfect storm of misinformation. The timing was just right. They weren't necessarily photoshopped pictures. They were real pictures, and they were able to just build this narrative around it that was, you know, pretty sure it was devastating for the campaign at that time. One of many, unfortunately, one of many devastating blows that they took. You know, based on misinformation.
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, that Hillary Clinton thing was 2 years ago today. It was on 9/11. She was coming out of the 9/11 commemoration ceremony at Ground Zero. And that's when it all went down. And of course, as soon as I saw the video, my heart sank because I knew exactly how it was going to be exploited. Even though she had pneumonia, anyone can get pneumonia. It wasn't some sort of indication of a long-term illness, but of course, it was spun that way. But, you know, the thing that I keep trying to forecast, although it's almost impossible to do that, is what is the 2020 iteration of social media interference? Because I know the Facebook and so on, they've all taken strides toward eliminating a lot of that. But, you know, as we've seen with doping and performance enhancing drugs in sports, the criminals are always fine. They're always one step ahead of the regulators. So
at least.
Yeah, exactly. And so what should we be aware of? Are there any indications whatsoever in terms of how they're going to now exploit social media now that these roadblocks are in place to keep them from doing it?
Well, I think the real question is not to focus on the specific techniques they're going to use, because as you say, that's always something. They find a weakness, exploit it till it's discovered, find the next weakness, exploit it till it's discovered. I think the real, the proper strategy is to take a step back from that and say, what's the goal here? The goal is to suppress turnout among populations that might vote for your opponent, and to spread misinformation that discourages people who might support your opponent.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the probably the most important thing to be doing is not to be looking for specific tactics, but to be looking for specific, I guess, markers, mm-hmm. and insisting that the social media companies in particular allow access to their data, such as advertising and account level information, to organizations that can track when this stuff is happening.
Yeah.
I know there's been some researchers have been very frustrated. I'm going to stay away from details here because I don't know exactly. I forget which service that it goes with, mm-hmm. but I know that there are. It's really important when a social media company bans a user that they don't immediately delete all of their data.
Yeah.
Because when that happens, you've basically eliminated the forensic trail that would allow you to go back and see, how they got there, who they were interacting with, who they influenced, and basically reconstruct the crime scene.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, having really that, I'm saying then that probably the most important thing for researchers and people who are involved with sort of counterintelligence on this to be doing is to be putting pressure on the organizations that are disseminating this data to be transparent and to preserve the data and treat it like evidence, not as as evidence to be used by the public, mm-hmm. rather than evidence of their own wrongdoing to be shredded as soon as possible.
Right, right. And one of the apps that I've been reading about lately, and there are a variety of different iterations of it, but generally under the heading of deepfakes, the latest one to come out is called Zao, Z-A-O. And I was reading about that. In fact, I wanted to try to download it because I wanted to experiment with it and write about it. But it turns out that even when you delete all of your information from Zao and uninstall it, they still retain all of it on their servers. And so that's one of the things that kind of referencing back to what you were just talking about. But in the broader discussion of deepfakes, that's the one that really concerns me as far as political interference and the ramifications, not just, I think, in politics, but in celebrity in general, where the degree of fraud that can take place with deepfakes. I don't think we've even been able to wrap our heads around all the different ways that can be weaponized. Now, I will say this too. It is a wonderful technology that could actually be used for so much good. In fact, I saw one in which they deepfaked Christopher Reeve's head onto Henry Cavill's head in Justice League. And I thought that was great to have Superman back in a movie. And so they could actually do that down the line with deepfakes, where they can get permission from Christopher Reeve's estate and cast him in another Superman movie if they wanted to do that once the technology gets more sophisticated. But there's also this much darker side that I think almost negates the value of the technology, at least from a consumer point of view. Don't you think that, or do you think that deepfakes is going to be something that we're going to have to face up as far as, the weaponization of it?
I'm not sure that that's going to, I think we'll see hints of that in 2020.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think the technology is such yet that, that we're going to see a, category 5 level problem there. But we've seen, Lord knows they can do enough damage with shallow fakes.
Yeah.
Let's go back to 2004 and the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth.
Oh my God.
That was, that was sort of the template for the modern, horrors that the it's Jerome Corsi, Roger Stone, all those guys, they're still around today. I mean, they're spending most of their time in court these days, but still they were, you know, up until a year or two ago, they were still doing what they do, and they hadn't really changed their game. They were just doing it in different ways. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of the, a lot of the impact of these things comes not from being good, but from being overwhelming.
Yeah.
I have an overwhelming volume of misinformation coming at you in mainstream news stories, in deceptively edited video clips that are otherwise accurate, that haven't been, you know, that haven't been deepfaked in any way. They've just been edited selectively just sending. I was reading about the hearing, the Mike Flynn sentencing hearing, and so, you know, and I saw some comments on a thread where there were people who were still pushing hard this bogus story that was pushed out by Roger Stone 2 years ago about a supposed teleconference that Andrew McCabe had, where he said, where in Roger Stone's telling of it, there were multiple people on this teleconference who said that Andrew McCabe, then the deputy director of the FBI, said, you know, we're going to fuck Flynn, and then after that, we're going to turn around, we're going to fuck Trump. And that story, I mean, people are still, if you go and you search that phrase, you will find every single large-scale right-wing sketchy media organization, has that story up on their website somewhere, and they just treat it like the gospel truth. Yep. And so you don't need deep fakes there to spread doubt among people. All you have to do is just keep a fire hose of bullshit spraying.
Yeah.
You know, for that last month before the election, when people are starting to vote by mail and vote early and vote absentee, and, you know, and leading up to Election Day, anything that you can do to get people to either decide, and most of it is voter suppression. Mm-hmm. Brad Parscale in 10 days before the 2016 election said, we have three separate voter suppression operations going on around the country. And he was proud of that.
Well, you know, and in fact, this takes us back to 2013, where I was observing this, and I'm sure you were too, where some bit of misinformation, you know, in fact, what was happening was receiving a lot of leads and a lot of headlines that would then get kind of reversed somewhere deeper in the article. And what we all know is that people generally only read the headline, and then fewer and fewer people read as you get deeper and deeper into the article itself. And so what was happening is you would have some sort of misinformation circling the globe several times before the truth and the reality of the story actually got its pants on. And so that happens so often, and especially with the stuff that you're referring to as shallow fakes, these propagandized misinformation campaigns. But going back to deepfakes, the one thing that I see that useful for today is, and I hesitate to even mention what's been going on in my head because I don't want to give them any ideas, but it seems like this is the purview of James O'Keefe and Project Veritas. Like, their whole MO is creating these selectively edited videos, right, that end up being fed to Republican members of Congress, and they end up legislating based on fake videos. I mean, proven in courts of law, fake videos. I can totally see James O'Keefe maybe doing something along the lines of a rat fucking, where he stages a P tape, stages Donald Trump in the hotel room in Moscow, and deepfakes Trump's face, makes it look like it's surveillance video. So you can do it really in a cloudy, fuzzy, low tech kind of way. And circulate that, and suddenly liberals are sharing that, and they go, ha ha, we got you, it's not real. And so that kind of shit is the stuff that wakes me up in the middle of the night in a cold sweat, thinking, wow, man, one of these guys, one of the James O'Keefe disciples, if not James O'Keefe himself, are totally going to love this technology if they're not on it already doing research and development. If, you know, maybe I'm giving them too much credit for being sophisticated.
I think you might be giving James O'Keefe too much credit because he's proven himself pretty good at getting caught.
Yeah.
But I think, if I'm recalling correctly, one of the concerns in the Steele dossier that Christopher Steele had was that there were indeed compromising tapes that were out there, and that there was a high degree of suspicion and very little confidence that they were real. And in fact, what they were seen as was disinformation being generated specifically to cloud the information environment. And so what you got in that case is you have two possibilities of things that could happen. Somebody could, from the opposition, could use it and then be exposed as having fallen for a fake, or they could use it themselves against a potential target of it who wouldn't, you know, who would know that it was a fake, but they'd be afraid of it. Mm-hmm. And you know, the Russian spy organizations, who are about, you know, 17 orders of magnitude more talented than James O'Keefe, would say, you know, mission accomplished.
Okay, we'll return to our conversation with Ed Bott here in just a second. But first, picture your face in the mirror. Do you see all those wrinkles around your eyes? How's about crow's feet or those large under eye bags? Now imagine, poof, they're gone. And I'm not talking about some risky, expensive plastic surgery. I'm talking gone in a matter of minutes while you're staring into the mirror in your bathroom. It is called Plexiderm, a clinically studied serum that visibly eliminates your wrinkles, crow's feet, and under eye bags in just minutes. It's the edge you've been looking for. Don't believe it? Well, I didn't either until I tried it. In fact, I thought, well, you got to put it on, you got to do it over and over again for 6 or 7 months until maybe you might see results. But no, I'm talking 10 years younger in about 10 minutes. Plexiderm can give you the confidence you'll need to be yourself at work or out with friends. The best part is Plexiderm goes on clear, so nobody knows that you're using it unless you tell them that you're using it. So go to tryplexiderm.com and use my code SEXYLIBERAL, two words, sexy and liberal, for 50% off plus an additional $10 off. That's right, 50% off plus an extra $10 off. This offer is also available by calling 1-800-685-1292 and mentioning the code SEXYLIBERAL. Plexiderm is backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. Visit tryplexiderm.com today and use the code SEXYLIBERAL at checkout. That's tryplexiderm.com.
The Bob Seska Show.
You know, why aren't trolls more sophisticated, especially on Twitter? They're so easy to pick out, at least I think to those of us who maybe have seen an episode or two of Rachel Maddow or have been online at all in the last couple of years. It seems like they're really just as clear as crystal. You see them pop up. They've got a weird handle, no profile pic, and a bunch of numbers after their name. What's keeping them from being more sophisticated? Not that I'm wanting that necessarily, but it's always kind of baffled me how obvious they make themselves.
Well, I think it goes back to what I was saying before, is this is the fire hose of bullshit. the more noise you have in a thread of replies to a Facebook post or a Twitter, you know, a Twitter announcement or something, you know, the more replies you have to that, the more discouraged somebody gets to scroll through it and look for the things that might be useful or interesting. So, and so it discourages people who are capable of contributing to the conversation from even participating. Mm-hmm. And it just drowns out the other stuff. But even more importantly, I think, is it makes it easier for the good trolls, the sophisticated, high-value, well-trained, good English speakers, it makes it easier for them to just sort of get lost in the noise.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Because every once in a while, you catch one where you're like, now, I don't know. Maybe that person's right. a troll. I really can't tell. I'm just going to assume. I just generally assume that they all are. So my blocking is very, very liberal, small L liberal on Twitter. That's for sure.
Yeah, eye for indiscriminate.
Exactly. Now, just kind of a side question, and I think something my listeners would be interested in knowing more about is the prevalence or lack of prevalence of click farms and troll farms, not just when it comes to political propaganda, but artificially inflating traffic where you can, if you have a website, you can go and hire. I know a lot of conservatives lately on Twitter have been caught buying followers on Twitter, similar to that. I mean, how prevalent is that? Is that a real thing? And should it be regulated where businesses shouldn't necessarily be allowed to inflate their traffic statistics, at least when it comes to advertising, using all of these click farms?
Well, it should be regulated, mm-hmm. But there's a big gap between what should be and what is.
Yeah.
In terms of advertising, the problem is real. One of the problems of regulating it is, you know, as you said earlier correctly, these guys are always, in this case, because the money, the monetary incentives are so huge, these folks are 4, 5, 6 steps ahead of everyone else. It's a huge problem for advertising. It's an arms war. And, you know, I don't know that in the current environment that we have that you're ever going to be able to eliminate it completely, yeah. just because of the way that these things have been architected. The bigger problem is that the internet is a global phenomenon, and so any kind of regulation that you do is only going to be as good as as whatever Wild West saloon the bad guys are operating out of, you know, and that might be. You know, typically there's a lot of the former Soviet bloc countries in Eastern Europe that are good for that. There's places in, in Asia that are doing that. And then on top of that, you get, you know, it's been fairly well established that North Korea was using similar techniques to generate funds for, for a lot of their operations.
Sure, yeah.
You know, so you get disorganized crime, you get organized crime, and then you get state level actors doing this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's really, really difficult to regulate something like that.
Oh yeah, certainly. And in fact, a lot of conservatives for decades have been bulk buying their own books to get them to place well on the New York Times bestseller list. And there still hasn't been any regulation or policing of that.
Yeah, that was the conservative book clubs would do that. And so, Jeanine Pirro's book would yep. magically appear in the top five.
Mm-hmm.
And because, you know, the conservative book club was sending them out to all of their members, they got there. It's influence operations are like that. They're designed to make you look like something you aren't.
Mm-hmm.
And in an environment where the First Amendment is paramount, mm-hmm. It's very hard to think of things that you can do to regulate speech
yeah.
that don't trample on good speech much harder than on bad speech. Because mm-hmm. bad speech, you know, they're not going to be deterred by laws and regulations.
Right, right. Well, I've got just a couple more questions if you have just a few more minutes, Ed.
You got it, Bob.
One of your primary beats is Microsoft. I mentioned this earlier. And, you know, I still run Windows 7's Pro 64-bit on all three of my podcast machines here. Naturally, every time I have a tech issue with the show and I post about it on social media, if I say anything whatsoever online about the fact that I'm using a Windows machine, most of my replies are unhelpful. They're basically all, get a Mac, Bob. how should I respond to Mac evangelists on social media? And what don't people get about Microsoft products?
That's a loaded question.
I know.
It's a very loaded question. It's also a time sensitive or a time dependent question, because I think the shouters out there make more noise than their actual representation in the population would justify. If you look in the comments to a lot of the articles that I publish at CDNet, for example, you would be convinced that Linux has probably a 30, 40, 50% market share on desktop PCs, because gosh almighty, there's so many, dedicated Linux users out there helpfully offering, telling people about what their favorite distro is and why they should, why they should download it and use it. The reality is, for people who understand what they're doing and know how to manage technology, a tool is a tool, and you could get great results with a Mac. You can get great results with Windows 7. You could get great results with Windows 10, and you could probably get great results with Linux too.
Yeah.
But what happens is instead that there's an 80-20 rule that goes on here. And that for 80% of the people who have a limited understanding of, and more importantly, limited time to understand technology, the much better thing to do is to try, is make a decision, choose a platform, stay current.
Yeah.
Staying a little bit behind is a small C conservative good thing to do if you don't like disruption, being the first, like iOS 13 is going to come out very, very soon. I know the Gold Master has been released. You never want to download the 0.0 release of iOS on your phone. Because within the next month, there will be two batches of patches that will fix the first level of bugs that could only have been discovered by putting it out into the wide world where everyone can use it with the tremendous number of apps and services that are out there, and then to expose the issues that are that are there. And I think the same is true with Windows and Macs. I tell people, there's people I know who I say, you should be using a Mac. This is, it fits into your lifestyle.
Yeah.
It fits into the other technology that you use. You're a good candidate for that. There are other people I say, you should probably be using a Windows PC. And there's one or two people I say, go for it. Ubuntu Linux.
Meantime, they rolled out the iPhone 11 yesterday. What do you think of that?
It looks like an excellent incremental update to some hardware that is really, really good to begin with. Mm-hmm. I think the interesting thing is that most of the takes that you hear from it about it from people are from people who live and breathe this stuff. But the people who are actually targets for, in the consumer sense, the targets for this new level of product are people who are using 3, 4, and 5-year-old iPhones, the iPhone 6, 6S, first generation 7, stuff like that. Boy, they'll buy a new phone. They won't be able to trade in their old one for anything, but that's okay. They got 4 or 5 years worth of use out of it.
Right.
They'll buy the new one, and the difference in performance and features and experience is just going to be staggering for them. And that's that's really the thing to keep in mind, is that if you say, well, it's not that much of an improvement over last year's iPhone XS, which in turn wasn't that much of an improvement over the iPhone X, which in turn, and you could do that.
Yeah.
But when you start taking a 20 to 30% improvement in performance with each generation, and you compound those the way that, interest does, pretty soon you're looking at something that is literally 4, 5, 6 times faster, sharper, more fun, and able to make you more productive. Mm-hmm. And by the way, the same thing is true with, the same thing is true with Samsung's products. The same thing is true with, PCs from Dell or Lenovo. So it's in a lot of cases, the people skip over the generations, and and they're just like, they're so pleasantly surprised.
Yeah, exactly. And I think I may skip over the 11 myself, but let me ask you this. We're coming up on 2020. We're coming up on the end of the decade. What is, in your opinion, the most significant development in tech during this decade since 2010?
You know, I don't think there's any question that it's Twitter.
Yeah.
For better or worse, the idea that we have a president who is in office, arguably because of Twitter, who is wreaking havoc and sowing chaos in the world through
his
Twitter
account.
That's a nice
way to put it. Yeah.
And all of that, you know, Twitter really came of age in this decade. I think it was introduced in 2007, and I got my account in 2008. But it was just sort of this little experimental thing, and I think it was really not until 2010 or 2011 that it just took off. And it's a media phenomenon now, and it influences the media so much. That's probably the thing that I would point to.
You know, we all spend a lot of time making fun of Twitter, but it's everything is happening on Twitter. I mean, whether it's celebrity news or just the immediacy of political news that we get on Twitter too, and the discussion that takes place around that, it is a significant thing. And you know what? I think I agree that it's Twitter. I guess iPhone was the first decade of the 2000s, but the Twitter would be this decade. Absolutely, 100%. Okay, my friend. Well, it was great talking to you, and I'm going to include all your links and everything in the description under this show and make sure everyone knows where to find you. So thank you so much for all your time today, Ed.
You got it, Bob. Thank you so much. Have a good one.
Take care, my friend. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This is Jody Hamilton, host of the podcast From the Bunker. If you enjoyed this episode, you'll love my show, where every week Sean Barton, David Shockett, and I discuss politics, sports, pop culture, that show on HBO that I don't watch. Find it at sexyliberal.com and on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, and everywhere else you get your podcasts.
Have you ever wondered how to say good morning in Italian? Or what is goodbye in French? You can ask Alexa. Just say, what is happy birthday in German? Or how do you say hello in Japanese? Do you want to know how to say I love you in Spanish? Ask Alexa and start learning a new language today.